Do you want to connect with clinicians, partners, investors, and experts who can speed up your scale-up in health tech? Our hands-on mentorship, guidance, and the program's suite of benefits can help you navigate the path to commercialization like the insider you'll soon be. To apply to be a Rosenman Innovator, go to rosenmaninstitute.org. Applications are open through April 12th.
No, you never know where life will take you. I think it's best to kind of have some guiding principles in deciding where you should go and what you should do. And then you let those guiding principles take you wherever they may.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Oren Levy, the CEO and co-founder of Sonomotion, a medical device startup developing non-invasive treatments for kidney stones. Oren's career path has taken him through a variety of fields, from studying physics and astronomy to working in management consulting, earning a PhD in biophysics, and diving into the med tech world. In this episode, Oren talks about finding your life's path through the pursuit of a good challenge, managing a startup's cash burn rate during a pandemic, and positioning yourself to take advantage of luck when it comes. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Oren. Thanks for joining me this morning on a very sunny day in San Francisco, at least. I don't know where you are joining us from. I suppose somewhere in the peninsula.
I'm close by. Yes, a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Well, thank you for participating in our podcast. And I thought it would be good to start. You are very UC person. You did your undergraduate at UC Berkeley and then your graduate degree as well. And so we are UC institution as well. But you studied biophysics and physics. Did you ever imagine that when you did your undergraduate in physics, you'd be doing what you're doing now? And how do you get from, you know, doing physics to do what you're doing now?
Yeah, which is medical device entrepreneurship. No, you never know where life will take you. I think it's best to kind of have some guiding principles in deciding where you should go and what you should do. And then you let those guiding principles take you wherever they may.
And what is your guiding principle?
Oh, well, mine, you know, they're mine and they could be different for others. But for me, what makes me happy is first the basics, you know, food, water, sleep. You got to have those things. Otherwise, no matter what, you're not really happy. After that is love. For me, I need to have love of some kind. It doesn't have, can be my cat or my dog or my wife or my kids, depending where I am in my life, right? But love is important. And then after that is a good challenge. I love a good challenge. I've always known that about myself, and then it didn't matter what it was. You know, English is actually not my first language, and I came to the States when I was about 13, and I didn't know any English, and that was a great challenge for me for that, you know, learn, and so I could play with the other kids, and then suddenly I had to learn for the SAT because I was going on the high school route here in the States, and I enjoyed that challenge, and physics gave me that challenge, and then astrophysics too, and then. Everything I've done, I just kind of chose the path that gave me a good challenge. So those are kind of my guiding principles. People tell me that money should be in there, making money or being successfully financially. And I think that's important. I think money is definitely important. It gives you a lot of flexibility and allows you to pursue what you may want to pursue. I think fundamentally, I'm not sure it makes one happy. At least it doesn't make me happy. But it's important to keep in mind, right? You don't want to work for free and you need money to run your company and investors give you money because they expect to receive a high return on their investment. And that's, you got to keep that in mind and you got to make that in the forefront. But as far as me, it's like, I, I, I need enough to have enough money to be happy, but it's not fundamental for making me happy.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you love challenges, and challenges can be like a fire in your belly, but it can also bring you down when you keep on trying for a long time. How do you keep that up, that fire in the belly, before you reach that point that you overcome that challenge? It takes a lot of hard work and persistence.
It is. You get knocked down and you get people to tell you that you can't do it or that whatever the reason may be. But I think you just got to keep the goal in mind. Like I said, this is what I want. This is what I want to achieve in 5-10 years. And I'm just going to go there. And I don't really care. You just have to believe in yourself. Doesn't mean that you don't adjust and you go, you know what? The thing that I thought I wanted was not a good idea. And it's okay to change. But it's best to say, this is where I want to be in 5-10 years. I want to be a professor. I want to be a CEO. I want to be chief scientist, whatever it is. I want to be on the beach surfing in 10 years, whatever it is. And then you just go for it. And you like a bulldog. You just don't care. You don't care. You see that wall. You want to walk through it. And until you do.
Some people kind of write their goal or even share their goal so that keep them honest, keep them going. Do you do that, or do you just have your internal goal and that's enough for you to drive you?
I don't, but I constantly talk to myself. It's like, I constantly remind myself of what it is I want. So I kind of do it already. But I don't write it down. You know what? I think it's a great idea to do so. And sometimes when I do and I go back and I find it a couple years later, it's actually really neat to see it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're a totally different person and or you've matured at least or changed or something has changed in your life. And it's neat to see. So I totally support it. I probably should, but I don't.
Well, I mean, the reason I was just listening to this guy, the actor Matthew McConaughey, I don't know how to pronounce his name.
That's right.
Apparently when he was young, he had that list. One of them is that he won an Oscar. And then he found that years later. And I was like, wow, it was so funny how that worked.
Yeah, you're right. I totally support writing it down.
So was Professor Academia was ever on your list? Doing a lot of PhD in physics, that's what I would imagine people do.
Not really. I like a good challenge. I love learning a new field. And, I did physics and astronomy, and then I worked for 7 years in Silicon Valley in management consulting, very business oriented. Didn't do a single integral, but learned a whole lot about business. And client management and project management and just people skills and psychology and kind of understand how the world worked. And then I was also part of a startup or two, and those were all new things to me at the time. But then I realized that I wanted to take a mental break and go do something interesting. And that's when I actually met my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and she was doing a PhD in genetics and kept asking her about, what she was doing. I was just interested. And it got to the point that she kind of said, well, you don't learn chemistry or biochemistry. You can't understand what I'm about to tell you. Your physicist thinks you know everything, but you don't. And I said, okay, try. And she did, and I didn't understand a thing she said. Okay, fine. I'll go take a chemistry class. And so I went to take a chemistry class in the junior college here in San Mateo, and enjoyed it. And then I started doing physical chemistry just on my side, taking some classes on the side in Berkeley before work, and then I went to work. And then I'm like, wow, this is a really interesting field. So then I just went to different labs on campus and said, I'd like to just volunteer, just hang out. And my startup failed at that point. It wasn't my startup. I was an employee there, but it failed. And so I said, well, I'll just go have fun on campus. And a lab took me in. And then it worked out really well. And that's how I pursued the PhD. I didn't even apply to graduate school. I just was in the lab and they said, you're doing pretty well and we like you enough. And you apply next year, we probably will let you in here in this program. So let's just save you a year and you jump right in. And that's essentially what happened. It was sort of, I was pursuing that challenge, right? Mm-hmm. Brand new area of biochemistry and DNA and RNA and proteins that do work on DNA in the nucleus. And I loved it. And so being a professor was never the thing. was pursuing the interesting topic that was. Mm-hmm.
And so you got to do your PhD. You know, you took a gap year between undergraduate, because some people, mm-hmm. when they do pursue PhD, they went straight to PhD. It must be quite interesting for somebody studying biophysics PhD, but then has a lot of background in business side.
Yeah, you know what? I think everyone should do that. I think if you go directly from first degree to the PhD, you are not well prepared for the PhD program because doing a PhD, at least in the sciences, require a lot of project management. You end up wasting often. You end up wasting a year or two, even three, because you're just inefficient in how you do things. Right? You do things serially, and then you realize you need some reagent. But that reagent takes 6 weeks to receive. So then you're not doing anything really productive for 6 weeks waiting for that reagent. And then you do the experiment and realize that was the wrong reagent. You have to order a different one. But if you were kind of thinking ahead, and that's, I had a whole project plan for my PhD. Like I was 6 months ahead. I was thinking, all right, here's the stuff I need. Here's the people that I need to help me. And so I need to go establish a relationship with those individuals. So when I need them in 6 months or a year or 2 years, they're there. And so I just pursued it as a project management exercise, as well as an intellectual, science research. And then, you know, I was also lucky. I worked with really smart people and on the right projects and ended up finishing the PhD in about 3.5 years, 4 years more like. Usually takes 5, 6, sometimes longer. Mm-hmm. Well,
that 6 months delay of that reagent, that can add up really quickly.
Yeah, but I was also lucky. And you know what? I think we should all keep in mind that in my opinion, to be successful, first and foremost, you need luck. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that. Yes.
But do you think, I mean, we all need luck, but, you know, some people seem luckier than others all the time.
Yes. Well, I think it's because they position themselves to take advantage of the luck when it comes.
Right.
And then they're there and they know what they want. And when they see it running by, they grab it. Right. So yes, you have to prepare yourself. You have to know what you want and all that. But end of the day, that thing, that luck thing that comes running across needs to happen. Someone needs to open that door. And a lot of it is luck. People you just meet randomly.
Right.
And that end up making all the difference in the world for you. Or you just happen to choose a career and you had no idea that's going to take you there. And suddenly you're in some great position. I think luck plays a big, big role in life. Like who you meet, who your significant other may be. I don't know. It's all luck, right? It completely changed your life. And I think it's important just to recognize. Sometimes you can beat yourself. Oh, I didn't succeed in something, whatever. And you know, sometimes, you know, luck is on your side. Sometimes not.
Yeah. Sometimes you just need to walk a bit further to meet for the right opportunity.
That's right.
So once you finish your PhD and then you said like, okay, you're not interested to become professor and I assume you're not interested to go back to management consulting work. And mm-hmm. how do you end up choosing the field of medical devices and start a company too?
Sure. Well, I think, so first I knew I liked entrepreneurship and I liked the life sciences quite a bit. And so I was exploring different possibilities. And so as I mentioned, I happened to see an advertisement that UCSF was putting together a Startup 101 in the life sciences field course that was in the afternoons meant for physicians or professors or students and kind of teach them how you get a company off the ground. And it was a great course. It was run by UCSF and Burl. And one of the kind of the projects at the end is, it's not in the end, it's like half the class, is that they put you together randomly with a group of two or three people, and somebody has an idea, and you go write just a business case for it. And I happened to be assigned with two surgeons out of UCSF who had an idea for a medical device. And I had no idea what a medical device, the field was. As a matter of fact, I didn't understand medicine at all. I mean, I understood physics. I understood a certain level of engineering. I understood the cell and the proteins inside the cell. But beyond the cell, the organism, the human beings, I was truly ignorant of really how all that worked, the different organs and how they interplayed. And so I was struck by how interesting it was, first, the human body, but secondly, it's field of medical devices, because it's a really interdisciplinary field. First, it involves the whole entrepreneurship aspect of it, right? So, which was great for me. Second of all, it has medicine, right? Which is a field I wasn't familiar with, right? So that was like the next challenge for me. But then it involved engineering, whether it's mechanical engineering or electrical engineering or manufacturing operations. And then there's a whole regulatory part of it, which can make life difficult sometimes, but it's also interesting. And the whole clinical trials aspect, all these fields are critical and it all has to come together in the right sequence. I was like, this is great. A field that will keep me constantly challenged, that actually makes a difference in the world. Before my PhD, I was in the high-tech field, in the internet e-commerce space. Mm-hmm. And, I was doing fine. You know, I had a nice salary. I saw my projection career-wise was going to be great. I wasn't worried. But I didn't really want to sell advertisement. I realized very early on that the internet was going down the one-to-one marketing route. And I just didn't care for advertising and the commercials. I was like, this is not where I want to be. I'll do okay there, but that's not where I'm deep. But for here, you've got a medical field where you can actually help people. And in the current startup that I have, Stone Emotional, where we're building tools for kidney stones, for the treatment of kidney stones in a non-invasive way with potentially no anesthesia. That's our goal. It's truly meaningful. I get calls, literally cold calls or emails on a weekly basis from patients who are literally suffering as I'm speaking to them in agonizing pain, and are looking for solutions, and saying, "What? I heard about your thing, and I hear it's in clinical trials. Where can I go?" and so they have to tell them, "Well, we don't have a site in Spain, or we don't have a site in New York. You're 2 hours away from Seattle. Well, we have a site there. Maybe you want to contact the PI there." And that's meaningful, right? We're really helping people. And I love that. I love that. On top of the challenge.
I think that what drives most people who are in this industry, because you see the impact so concretely.
Yeah.
With the work that you've done. So that's great.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping med tech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So one of the things, this is your Stone Emotion is your first time CEO role. And I'm sure when you started that job, you have a lot of experience being in the business and the PhD, you have overcome many challenges. And what went through your mind the first time? It's like, is this just another challenge or just, do you have doubt or, what are the things that went through your head when you decided, like, this is, I'm going to start a company?
Well, I decided that I wanted to be to lead a medical device company 15 years ago, and I remember telling the CEO of Fluid Medical. I was always like the second or third employee at Fluid Medical, and early on, Steve was like, "Oh, what is it you want to do in life?" And I was like, "You know, I would love in 5-10 years to have your job." And he goes, "Okay, all right, then let's start." And he kind of took me under his wings. And so there's a meeting this afternoon with someone who's going to be doing our animal work, and so you should get familiar with this. And then he brought me into all the fundraising meetings that he had with the VCs just to give me exposure. He didn't need me there, but he gave me that exposure. So he took me under his wing. And so I wanted to be, I guess, CEO of medical device and start a company for years. And so I was constantly collecting data and collecting things I should do and things I should not do. Mm-hmm. And then it was, you know, a good 3 or 4 years before I started Soda Motion that I felt I was ready. Mm-hmm. And I let my network know. I was like, I think I'm ready. I think I want to do this. If you have an idea, let me know. And, you know, and so when some, and so we should talk maybe later about how I even found about Soda Motion. Right.
I was about to ask you that question.
Yeah, it's not my idea. But by the time I was, you know, the idea came to me, was brought to me, I was ready mentally. I felt like I had enough experience. And the fact is, you're never fully ready. You can't be. There's no way. There's too many disciplines to be a master of. And so sometimes you just, not sometimes, but usually you figure
just
things
out. Jumped.
You jump into it and you figure things out. And you hope that you're smart enough and you have enough network and support to help you. Just go for it.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's another thing, that you have that person willing to take you on his wing. I think that's also a luck. Is also that somehow you can convince other people to let him take you on his wing too.
That's true. That's true. And I'll give you an example of both luck and positioning yourself for success. Once I knew medical device is where I wanted to go, I went and just audited courses everywhere, UCSF, at Stanford. I just literally just walked into Stanford class and just sat in the back and listened. And it was a class by the biodesign program where they brought in leaders in the field that gave a talk to the students. And one of them was, you know, Steve Rudy. And afterwards, I went to talk to him and said, "Hey, I'm really interested in the field. And you know, here's, you know, I have my resume. I'll be interested in, I'll be happy just to help you. You know, just spend time with you." And he said, "Oh, okay, all right, right." And then a couple weeks later, he called me and said, "Hey, Warren, I may have a mini project for you. I'd like you to help me better understand the process flow in a cath lab under these conditions." And the moment that he called me, I happened to be in a cath lab at El Camino Hospital. I just kind of talked my way into it. I just met a cardiologist and said, "I'd love to just be there and learn and observe." And literally, Steve calls me while I'm there. I'm like, "Well, I'm there. Tell me." See how that luck plays. But I, of course, I kind of position myself to get lucky, if you will. So anyways, yes, that's how I got into Fluid Medical originally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. That's how, like, you know, life is sometimes, timing is everything.
I agree.
Yeah. And, you know, there's always more timing, but I think that that moment, that the right moment, then you always remember, oh, that's a perfect timing. But just because you miss one timing, I'm sure there's more timing that would be perfect as well. So you jumped in like as a first time CEO, and you know, you successfully raised your Series B just before the pandemic, and I think that's, you know, great. I always tell entrepreneur who managed to do that before the pandemic is like, what a perfect timing. But I feel like at the same time, even if it's not, even if you didn't, with your ability to overcome challenges, I think you probably would you know, get your funding one way or the other, because I think you have that grit. So now what? Now that you get all these funding, that's the real work begin. And with all the COVID, how do you continue doing your clinical study? How do you make sure that you don't, when you project plan, you don't waste your 6 months, like, whoops, the reagent's wrong reagent.
That's right. Well, the fact is that this pandemic is a problem, not just for society and all the folks who are getting sick and dying. It's terrible for the economy. And from a startup perspective that is in clinical trials right now, like, our success depends on our ability to do clinical cases. Mm-hmm. But it has been impossible to do any clinical cases since March. We actually just been able to do our first case since the pandemic started a couple of weeks ago. But it took, we have to move mountains to make it happen. And now the new surge that is occurring right now, where now we're in December, right? It's going to be a mess. And the hospitals just don't want you around if it's not a must do procedure, right? Which I completely understand. At the same time, you have a burn rate, right? You're spending money, right? You have employees, you're burning. And to hit a milestone, you need to do these, you know, clinical cases. So I think that what it means is that those companies are not well financed that were fortunate enough and had the foresight maybe to get the money when they could. Mm-hmm. Those companies that don't are in trouble. They're just going to run out of money. Mm-hmm. And it's and there's some great ideas and great teams, and either they're going to have to get funding not as good of a terms as they could have a year ago, and some of them will just fail, and that's just the truth of it. Now, for those who do have the funding that can weather the storm, I think you focus the team on improving the product, right? No matter what product you have, you know what you need to do to improve it. And that's what my team has done beautifully. We had plans for Gen 2 already. I mean, we're doing first-in-human feasibility trials in Canada and the U.S. with our Gen 1, and we're quite happy with what we're seeing, but we're also seeing what needs to improve. And so we just focus on those improvements. Yes. And you know, a lot of times, I don't know of any medical device that just worked immediately, right out of the box. You always realize, oh, I need to make this change, I need to make that change, whatever the case may be. But you're also, you know, doing clinical trials at the same time. You're trying to fundraise, and here this pandemic, in some ways, is in a way a blessing, I suppose, because it's the only thing that was available to us was to make the product better. And so that's what we did, and that's what we're doing. And it could be that, you know, if this pandemic really goes in the direction we think it's going to go, which is not pretty, we may not be able to do elective surgeries, never mind clinical, you know, research, which is elective. You know, it could be until April. By that time, we'll have our Gen 2 ready to go. So maybe it's a blessing, I guess.
It kind of like, I think knowing that a lot of the pieces allow you to focus where your energy needs to be based on the external environment. And I think, if you don't have the full picture, sometimes you get lost, but the fact you kind of have an overview of everything is like, okay, you can't do this now. What are the things that we need to get it done anyway? So I think many of that approach seems to be adopted by many of the CEO that I talked to.
And you know what else is, you know, we have always kept our burn rate low, as low as we could. I learned that lesson a long time ago. You know, at one point in one of the startups I was in, we had 2 weeks of runway. Like, I had more money in my own personal checking account than the company did. That's not a good sign. We actually in the end pulled it off, and So we found money out of the couch, if you will, and eventually our company got acquired. So we somehow succeeded, but it was very challenging. And I remember thinking to myself, of all the things that we spend money on that maybe we didn't need to, and how nice it would have been to not have spent that money. And so when I started Swim Emotion, I was very, very cash conscious. And so we kept a burn rate low in our, you know, number of employees. We hired the best we could, the folks that could do multiple things. And I made sure everybody were happy and their needs were met. And, cause I didn't want to lose anybody. You know, we haven't lost anybody since we started 5-6 years ago. Everybody's super dedicated. Everyone's super good. But we kept our costs down. And so that put us in a position to weather this kind of storm. But it's a balance though. You know, you don't want to go too slow, right? If you don't have enough firepower, you're going slower than you need to. And so it's a constant balance of am I going fast enough? Could I go faster? But then my burn rate goes up. Then this pandemic hits and you go, oh, geez, I'm glad I kept my costs down. But
your project planning experience probably really helped understanding that strategic thinking, where to spend the money, where to conserve the money.
That's right. Where to hire consultants, you can turn more on and off as needed. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I definitely recommend people go to that. Try it at least a year doing that kind of work. Before studying, but you know, that's not always have to be the case. I mean, maybe before we end our conversation, I know that you mentioned earlier before the pandemic that you raised the Series B. Congratulations again. I thought it was interesting your investor base are both the US and international, and how, you know, I think nowadays, entrepreneurs, especially in a med tech space, they need to be more open about finding investor base outside the US. And how do you find them? And how do you, you know, is this the same way how you get into the El Camino Hospital Gath Lab?
Yes. I would say that the venture community in the US is really not doing early stage medical device investments, unfortunately. They say they do, but they just redefine early stage to mean, you know, solid first human data and maybe even regulatory approval. To me, that's not early stage, but they just redefined it and they say they do early stage, but they really don't. There are some, but they're rare. And so you have to go outside the US. There's a lot of money in Singapore and China. Japan has a lot of distributors and companies that sometimes are looking for innovation, and they be willing to put a few million dollars for maybe a distribution right. And so you may give up distribution rights in Japan, but be able to start the company. So that's where I would go pursue and funding. Now, equally so, and in parallel, the non-dilutive funding routes, meaning SBIR, small business innovation research grants from the NIH, from NASA, from the DOD, Department of Defense, NSF, are great ways to start. You know, they're slow, that they have some cons to them, but they literally come with millions of dollars potentially that are non-dilutive, you don't have to give any equity for, and it helps you hone in your story as well. And it helps you start your company and prove and de-risk the issues that exist before you bring on equity folks. And so I would strongly encourage anybody who has an idea to go down that route and pursue that. You'll probably fail the first time, maybe even the second time, but pursue that aggressively. And I would recommend not hiring an outside writer to help, because you need to understand the material, and it's a lot of work, but it's well worth it. But I wouldn't, but at the same time, the SBIR route and non-dilutive route is not the only route you should take. You shouldn't try to do that before you start. You should try, should anything that move, go talk to everybody, while you're pursuing the SBIR, because they take a long time to mature. It takes 3 months to write a grant, and then it takes 9 months if you receive the grant before you see any money, right? So it passes before you even see anything. And then the other thing is physicians. If your idea is really good, it will attract physicians. And physicians tend to have extra funding available to themselves. Initially we had two urologists. They invested, a small amount, but it was a lot for us at the time. And, they believed in it and they've done other investments before. And so they're willing to take a bit of a chance. And then suddenly in Series B, we had over 50 physicians who invested in Sun Emotion. We had, at AUA, the big urology conference, we had a booth and we did live demos of where we were breaking stones in 5 minutes, things that would take an hour and a half for them to do in the surgical suite. We were doing in front of them in 5-10 minutes. And they kind of went and looked at it and go, oh, you might put me out of business if you really succeed.
I need to diversify.
And some of them, said, oh, this would fit perfectly into what I'm doing. And suddenly we had over $2 million in investment to physicians. And that helped attract other investors, other institutional and strategic investors. Because they said, wow, you got 50 end users who invested in you? And not like, 10K or 15K, like 2 million worth? Wow. Okay, I'm paying attention. Let's talk more. And so we end up having, in Series B, a strategic out of Singapore, and we've been wonderful on the board and very supportive. It's Dornier AMTH out of Singapore. And our original investors from Series A, the VC firm out of Japan, MPI, that also been fantastic. And I've worked with for now more than 10 years. So there's that personal relationship. And so that's why they really led Series A, because they believed in me and obviously the idea too, that fully validated it. But no way, there was that personal relationship. And so if I could leave, the audience with one thing, is that your network is critical. It's that network that's going to get you that CEO role. And it's that network that's going to bring in, connect with investors. It's that network that's going to solve your problems. I can't tell you how many times I've met with my friend Bill Disley and I said, I'm looking for a clinical lead, or I got this problem, I need a regulatory advice. And Bill's like, oh, I got the perfect person for you. And it totally turned into the case, like 3 or 4 times, totally solved major problems for me just by having coffee with my friend. And so you want to have those kinds of friends around, and they'll tap into you and you tap into them. And so, you want to do a good job, whatever you do, be a superstar. So people, want you to be on their team, and when you need them, they'll be there, and vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that Rhythm Institute is trying to do, is to gather a lot of these founders and, connect them so that they become friends. And friends helps each other's friends, it's easier to help friends. It's easier to pick up the phone to call a friend.
Yeah.
And they don't want to, put you in the direction that they know is going to be bad for you. That's the nice thing about having friends. So I have so many more questions. I wish we have more time. It's been really a pleasure to have you, and maybe we can have a part two in a year or so after this whole pandemic is over.
More pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Aaron.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.